Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 258. It's Monday, May 20th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started up with the weather, which now includes wildfire smoke. This from the Environmental Health Network. Wildfires in Canada worsen air quality across the U.S. Midwest. Wildfire smoke from Canadian blazes has dramatically worsened air quality across the Midwestern United States, permeating indoor environments despite efforts to keep it out. And if you want more details, you can check out this story at Inside Climate News. But in short, more than 140 wildfires in Alberta and British Columbia have sent smoke across U.S. borders, affecting indoor air quality even with closed windows and doors. Experts emphasize the importance of high-quality air filtration systems to combat the infiltration of outdoor pollutants indoors. Vulnerable groups like children and the elderly face significant health risks from prolonged exposure to this smoke. Housing quality plays a big role in this. If you're in an older, leakier home, you're going to be exposed to more wildfire smoke. Why this matters? As climate change escalates, the frequency and severity of wildfires, more individuals will likely experience adverse health effects from smoke exposure. Effective indoor air quality management is becoming important for health safety, particularly in densely populated and vulnerable communities. And I would add that Ohio is ranked last among states in air quality. Yikes. If you want to monitor this yourself for local conditions, for air quality, you can go to airnow.gov. That's airnow.gov. Okay, well, one of the reasons Ohio ranks last in air quality is we have a lot of oil and gas development. This from Energy News. As Ohio clamps down on clean energy, recent changes make it easier to force landowners to allow oil and gas drilling. Ohio has seen a big jump in the number of agency orders forcing property owners to allow oil and gas development on their land, whether they want it or not. The number of so-called unitization orders issued by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources has surged in recent years, peaking at 112 in 2022 and continuing at nearly 100 last year, according to data obtained from the agency by the Energy News Network. The practice is common, with rules varying by state. In Ohio, lawmakers began working to streamline the process for oil and gas companies in 2019, coinciding with a decline in the state's gas production after a seven-year fracking boom. Those changes run contrary to other efforts in Ohio to restrict energy development in the name of neighbors' private property rights, including strict wind farm setbacks passed in 2014 and a 2021 law allowing counties to block new wind and solar projects. Under Ohio law, companies must meet several conditions before initiating unitization, including a showing that at least 65% of property owners in a project area consent to drilling. Hearings don't consider environmental impacts or other reasons landowners might not want drilling and fracking. It's just not part of the evaluation, said Heidi Robertson, a Cleveland State University law professor who has written about unitization. Rather, she said, the basic question is, will adding this land to the unit make it easier for the developer to more efficiently and more profitably get the oil and gas out of the ground? The answer is almost always yes. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources has denied only one unitization application since 2012, according to spokesperson Andy Chow. Meanwhile, it has approved more than 500 applications, with more than half the orders issued after 2020. The agency hired an additional employee in 2021 just to deal with the increase in applications. Owners whose property is unitized won't have pads or roads on their property, but they still get royalties and other payments. Ohio law requires, quote, just and reasonable compensation to landowners. In most cases, that compensation starts with a 12.5% royalty. Additional payments are adjusted for the developer's expenses and other factors, and the compensation is often smaller than that for voluntary participants. Orders typically have let companies recoup twice these amounts before unitized landowners can get payouts beyond royalties, said attorney Matthew Onest, whose firm has represented multiple landowners in oil and gas matters. In some cases, property owners must wait even longer. At a March 27 hearing, for example, drilling company EAP Ohio asked for a 500% penalty for owners who did not agree to a lease. Anna Biblowitz, a negotiator for Encino Energy, claimed the higher penalty was justified by the developer's risk and as a motivator for other working interest owners to participate. A ruling in the case is due this month. Some property owners worry about climate change and other environmental impacts. They said companies won't agree to requested lease terms for no flaring, methane monitoring, and monitoring of the spring on their property. These oil and gas companies aren't addressing the important issues of our environment. State officials have made the process easier, too. In 2019, lawmakers added language about how to calculate the 65% threshold, tucking the terms into a 2,600-page state budget law. Matt Hammond, who was then the president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association, told lawmakers the added language was meant to, quote, clarify the law. In practice, the change likely lowered the barrier for companies to use the tool, according to Cliff Little, an Ohio State University Extension educator. If you're seeing actually more cases for forced unitization, that would be a significant player in that, Little said. Another law passed in 2022 requires the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to hold hearings on unitization applications within 60 days. The agency must rule within 60 days of the hearing and also let companies know in advance if an application is incomplete. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources also changed its guidelines last year to standard unitization applications. The agency's website said the changes were aimed at streamlining the review process and that applications would include fewer documents. Among other things, companies don't need to file testimony from engineers, geologists, and landmen in advance of hearings, something they had generally done in the past. That further limits any dissenting landowner's ability to prepare challenges to such testimony when the hearing does take place. So, unfortunately, it looks like the oil and gas developers have the upper hand here over property owners who may not want oil and gas development on or under their property.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, let's turn to a little bit better news on the regulatory front. This from foodpolitics.com. The FDA's new agricultural water rule. The headline caught my eye. FDA publishes landmark final rule to enhance the safety of agricultural water. This addresses a big problem, contamination of agricultural land growing produce by bacteria in animal waste running off from concentrated animal feeding operations and dairy farms. The new rule requires annual evaluation of the water system, water use practices, crop characteristics, environmental conditions, potential impacts on water from the adjacent nearby land, and other relevant factors. Testing pre-harvest agricultural water. Implementation of mitigation measures needed, especially those associated with adjacent and nearby land uses. In the usual way the FDA does these things, farms have roughly 1 or 2 years after the final rule is published to comply. The agency says it is committed to taking an educate before and while we regulate approach to supporting compliance. I'm not sure what that means, but this rule can't be implemented soon enough. Next, USDA has to do the same thing for water on concentrated animal feeding operations and dairy farms. So this will get at the pollution that goes off the farms and livestock concentrated animal feeding operations. But, of course, the people that work in those environments are also subject to problems. And, of course, one of the interesting things that I've reported on before is that a lot of times when you hear about food poisoning, it's often like vegetable crops, you know, might be, spinach or lettuce or something like that. But it isn't because those crops have any particular susceptibility to contamination by the nature of the crops. It's because they're close by water sources that are polluted by concentrated animal feeding operations and dairy farms. So once again, even if you were eating no animal products, no livestock, you would still be subject to the negative effects, the sort of secondhand pollution from all the manure and such that gets thrown into the water system and pollutes nearby farms and contaminates food. Well, that kind of contamination may be your regular old bugs that are toxic, but superbugs can pose an even bigger problem. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Superbugs pose a greater threat than COVID, warned health expert. England's former chief medical officer claims that the rise of drug-resistant superbugs could present a crisis worse than the COVID pandemic. In short, Professor Dame Sally Davies, the UK special envoy on antimicrobial resistance, emphasizes the urgent need to address superbug resistance, which she views as more severe than climate change. Drug-resistant infections, killing over 1.2 million people annually, could jeopardize modern medical procedures like surgeries and cancer treatments if not controlled. It looks like a lot of people with untreatable infections, and we would have to move to isolating people who are untreatable in order not to infect their families and communities. So it's really a disastrous picture. Why this matters? The growing threat of antibiotic-resistant pathogens poses a potential global health crisis that could dwarf the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as I've reported before, if we don't deal with this problem well, it is actually possible that antimicrobial-resistant superbugs could be the leading cause of death worldwide. Yikes. Okay, next up, article in the category of war is bad for public health. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Environmental damage from wars must be addressed in peace accords. Conflicts in Ukraine, Gaza, and Colombia show the urgent need to include environmental restoration in peace agreements to ensure long-term sustainability and peace. In short, Colombia's peace accord includes extensive environmental provisions, serving as a model for other conflict zones like Ukraine and Gaza. Few peace agreements globally include environmental protections, highlighting Colombia's unique approach. Environmental damages from wars are vast, including contamination, deforestation, and infrastructure destruction. Why this matters? Addressing environmental damage in peace accords is critical for sustainable recovery and long-term peace. Neglecting this aspect can lead to prolonged health crises and renewed conflicts. Okay, well, next up, let's look at the shifting global health landscape. This is from Reuters. Obesity and high blood sugar play ever-growing role in ill health globally, study shows. Obesity, high blood sugar, and high blood pressure, among other metabolic issues, now lead to almost 50% more years of healthy life loss to either disease or premature death than they did in the year 2000, shows a major international study. Over the same period, the number of years lost due to factors associated with undernutrition for mothers and children, such as stunting or wasting, dropped by 72%. The Global Burden of Diseases, Injuries, and Risk Factors Study 2021, published in The Lancet, used data from 204 countries and territories to identify the leading causes worldwide of illness and early death. These are measured in disability-adjusted life years, or DALYs. The data shows a clear shift in global health challenges as populations age and lifestyles change, the author said. Although air pollution was the biggest risk factor for both premature death and death in the 2000 and the 2021 data. They also pointed out the results were not uniform. Undernutrition remained a major risk factor in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. Ill health among 15 to 49-year-olds worldwide was increasingly attributable to a high body mass index and high blood sugar, two risk factors in the development of diabetes. Future trends may be quite different than past trends because of factors such as climate change and increasing obesity and addiction. Okay, next up, let's do a diet story. This from the University of California, San Francisco, Prostate Cancer Study, Why More Health Benefits from Plant-Based Diet. A study of more than 2,000 men with localized prostate cancer found that eating a primarily plant-based diet was associated with a 47% lower risk that their cancer would progress compared with those who consumed the most animal products. This amounted to eating just one or two more servings per day of healthy foods, particularly vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, while eating fewer animal products like dairy and meat. The study followed the men whose median age was 65 years old over time to see how dietary factors affected the progression of their cancer. Progressing to advanced disease is one of many pivotal concerns among patients with prostate cancer, their family, caregivers, and physicians. This adds to numerous other health benefits associated with consuming a primarily plant-based diet, such as reduction in diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and overall mortality. And it's also important just to note that the dietary benefits can, of course, prevent cancer in the first place, but this is a good example, particularly a slow-growing cancer like prostate cancer typically is. A good diet can slow the progression to more severe disease. Okay, next up, let's do some stories on maternal mental health. This from The Hill. Most states receive D's and F's in maternal mental health report card. About 1 in 5 pregnant or postpartum women in the United States will experience a mental health disorder like depression, anxiety, or suicidal ideation, according to the American Psychiatric Association. But very few of these women will receive treatment. Nearly every state in the country is doing a poor job meeting the mental health needs of new and expecting mothers, according to a new report from the Policy Center for Maternal Mental Health. In the report, 24 states scattered across the country received D grades, and 5 states received a failing grade for their efforts to help recent or expecting mothers for their mental health. So 29 of the 50 states received a D or E. Yikes. States were graded across 3 categories: providers and programs, screening and screening reimbursement, and insurance coverage and treatment. Overall, the country earned a grade of D+, a slight improvement from what the nation earned in the 2023 maternal mental health report card. Last year, the U.S. earned a D grade, with 40 states plus Washington, D.C. receiving D's or F's. So we've bumped up from 40 states flunking to 29. Not too bad. We're seeing incremental improvements in state efforts to address maternal mental health and improvements on the state-level data that is available, said Caitlin Murphy, a research scientist at the George Washington University's School of Public Health who helped create the report cards. Yet, grades are still dismally low. States should be commended for their hard work to address maternal mental health disparities, and we still have a long way to go. And on that front, from Roll Call, administration releases maternal mental health plan. The Biden administration last Tuesday announced the first national maternal mental health strategy, seeking specific action from Congress and multiple federal agencies to reduce the effects of untreated mental health and substance use conditions during and after pregnancy. The plan and a report to Congress come as conditions related to mental health and substance use account for the largest share of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. The U.S. also leads among maternal deaths compared with other high-income countries. The strategy is split into 5 buckets: data and research, prevention, screening, and diagnosis, intervention and treatment, community practices, and community engagement. Each of these buckets includes recommendations that seek to strengthen a nation's perinatal mental health infrastructure and reduce disparities, increase access to affordable health services, use data to improve maternal outcomes, promote educational and community partnerships, and highlight the insight of people with their lived experiences. One recommendation calls for requiring states to provide 12 months of postpartum coverage through Medicaid, up from 60 days, which is the current requirement. While the 2021 COVID relief law enabled states to simplify the process to extend Medicaid postpartum coverage with federal support, not all states have taken up this option. It also asked Congress to pass a law that would create a national benefit of 6 months of paid family and medical leave and establish universal child care in all states, in line with efforts from the House Bipartisan Paid Family Leave Working Group. Other recommendations seek to increase Medicaid reimbursement for support staff, encourage Congress to enact laws that would strengthen the perinatal mental health workforce using existing state block grant funding, find ways to integrate mental health into obstetric and primary care visits, and increase surveillance across agencies on key maternal mental health issues that require more coordination. The impact of the 2022 Supreme Court decision to overturn the right to an abortion has also complicated mental health for some. 23% of pregnancy-related deaths are caused by suicide, drug overdoses, or other outcomes from mental health or substance use disorders. Many state abortion bans enacted after the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision do not include exceptions for mental health emergencies, suicidal ideation, or both. It would be a mistake for us to have this conversation and not note what Dobbs has meant to the mental health and well-being of women across the country, because it's not only about their physical health, it's about their mental health as well. And unfortunately, this is an old disparity between physical and mental health conditions, that these exceptions only deal with physical health, not the mental health of the pregnant woman. And next up, while there has been a lot of changes in abortion care in the last couple years, the number of total abortions overall in the U.S. continues to go up. This from The Hill. Survey finds telehealth is driving increase in abortions, despite state bans. In the 18 months versus Roe v. Wade being overturned, the number of abortions in the United States has continued to grow, according to new data, even as 14 states have banned abortion completely. The report from the Society for Family Planning's We Count project found much of that growth was likely related to telemedicine, which accounted for 19% of all nationwide abortions by last December. The report was also the first to fully capture the impact of providers who use blue state shield laws to offer telehealth options. Abortions. Shield laws give some legal protections to clinicians who offer abortion care via telehealth to people who live in states that have total abortion bans or severe restrictions. In 2023, five states had shield laws in effect: Colorado, Massachusetts, New York, Vermont, and Washington. Since the WeCount data was collected, Maine and California have also passed shield laws, protecting providers who offer care nationwide. Nearly 8,000 people per month in states with bans or severe restrictions were getting medication abortion from clinicians operating under shield law protections from October through December of last year, making up nearly half of all telehealth abortions counted in a report. And I would note that that's almost 10% of all abortions in the country were happening by these telehealth abortions in states with bans or severe restrictions. Access to medication abortion through telehealth continues to play an ever-increasing role in abortion care nationwide, even as the Supreme Court weighs the fate of telehealth abortion care, said Ushma Upadhyay, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco's Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health and the co-chair of WeCount. In the 15 states with total or six-week abortion bans, the report estimated that more than 180,000 abortions would have likely been obtained through clinic providers had abortion not been banned. The states with the greatest cumulative declines in abortion volume over 18 months include Texas, Georgia, Tennessee, Louisiana, and Alabama. Even as the total number of abortions nationally has increased, we can't lose sight of the fact that access to in-person abortion care has virtually disappeared in states where abortion is banned, said Allison Norris, a professor at the Ohio State University College of Public Health and a WeCount co-chair. The loss of clinic-based care, which makes up more than 80% of abortion care, is a devastating loss to access for people across wide swaths of the country. And next up, we have a story on a population has particular vulnerabilities with the new abortion restrictions. This from The Hill. Almost 7 million black women of reproductive age have little or no abortion access. More than 50% of black girls and women of reproductive age live in states with little or no abortion access, according to a new report. The analysis from National Partnership for Women and Families and the In Our Own Voice National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda found that nearly 7 million black women age 18 to 49 live in the 26 states that have banned or are likely to ban abortion. The study found that 2.7 million black women living in the 26 states are economically insecure, and 1.4 million of them work in service jobs. These situations make it less likely for pregnant women to access resources, such as paid sick days, flexible scheduling, and the financial capabilities to travel to states that allow abortion. More than 58% of the women in these states are also already mothers, but polling from In Our Own Voice found that, since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, 46% of black women in these states reported thinking about not having any additional children. 34% reported worrying about being arrested in relation to a pregnancy, miscarriage, or abortion care. 43% also reported thinking about the risk of maternal mortality to themselves or a partner. Black women have some of the highest rates of maternal mortality, though most maternal deaths are in fact preventable. The report states that abortion bans exacerbate the maternal mortality rate for minority women because hospitals have closed their maternity wings, creating widespread maternity care deserts. In some cases, providers are leaving states with abortion bans, adding to the shortage of healthcare providers. Those who stay may be forced to compromise care, including to women experiencing pregnancy complications or emergencies. So, those women that are subject to restrictions are more likely to be black women. Okay, well, next up, let's switch gears and go to a story that gets at the mistrust that can be developed by living in a for-profit healthcare system. This from MedPage Today. Nurses don't trust employers to safely implement AI tools, survey shows. 3 out of 5 nurses said they don't trust their employer to place patient safety as the most important factor when using artificial intelligence, that is AI tools, according to a survey from the National Nurses Union, the largest union of RNs in the U.S. Nurses said they are alarmed by the growing influx of unregulated AI tools in healthcare, including predictive models used to determine staffing assignments, computer-generated reports that replace nurse-to-nurse handoffs when shifts happen, and chatbots that replace triage nurse, which they argue undermine clinical judgment and compromise patient care. Nurses are not against technology, said Deborah Berger, president of the National Nurses Union. We embrace technology that enhances patient care and is used in conjunction with our own extensive education and clinical experience. However, we are opposed to this wild west of unregulated and unchecked gadgetry, parading as a panacea for all that ails healthcare. We want the public to hit the pause button on the current reckless push by big tech and healthcare companies to force AI technologies onto our patients, us, and the healthcare workers without our knowledge or consent. We will not allow our patients to be the guinea pigs. The National Nurses Union recently published the Nurses and Patients Bill of Rights, Guiding Principles for AI Justice in Nursing and Healthcare, which underscores the need for safety, privacy, transparency, and high-quality person-to-person care, as well as the right to exercise professional judgment. The burden of demonstrating safety should rest with developers and employers, not patients and their caregivers, the nurses noted. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is, if you listen to this show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if perchance that should not be the case, I will gladly refund triple your money. And of course, healthcare profiteers focus on the short-term profits. This next story, though, gets at playing the long game, which is that of public health and preventive health. This is from MedPage Today. When it comes to preventive health, play the long game. The Senate has an opportunity to increase access to preventive health interventions by passing legislation that would better measure the long-term budget savings that these interventions would generate. Senators should pass that legislation without delay. The Preventive Health Savings Act, which the House passed in March, would empower the Director of the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, to determine whether a proposed measure of preventive health and preventive health services would reap budget savings more than 10 years into the future. And if so, then require the Congressional Budget Office to include that analysis of budget savings in its overall projection of the measure. Currently, CBO projects the budgetary impact of legislation over a period limited to 10 years. This bill would empower CBO's director to measure the budgetary impact of preventive health interventions for the two decades after those first 10 years. Why should the Senate pass this measure? Because potential savings from preventive health interventions often come well beyond the first 10 years. The more that lawmakers focus on the longer term, the likelier they are to enact preventive health measures that will not only lead to budget savings, but would also improve the health of millions of Americans. Chronic and mental health conditions comprise an estimated 90% of the nation's approximately $4.5 trillion health care bill. And to a great extent, health care spending drives overall federal spending. In fact, toward the middle of the century, major federal health care programs are projected to comprise nearly 40% of all federal spending, not counting interest payments on the national debt. Medicare alone is projected to account for more than two-thirds of the increase in federal health spending over the next 30 years. Prevention works. Clinical preventive services such as certain cancer screenings, immunizations, and substance use counseling reduce illness and save lives. Community preventive services such as smoke-free policies, motor vehicle injury prevention, and diabetes prevention programs such as physical activity and dietary changes also improve health. Federal projections of longer-term savings from preventive health care measures could incentivize lawmakers to enact more such measures and thus improve the health of Americans for decades to come. Yep, let's play the long game. And next up, we have an interesting study coming out of China, how a set of policies can reduce sedentary behavior among children. This from Medical Express. World-first regulations to combat sedentary behavior among children in China shows global promise. Pioneering measures to tackle sedentary behavior among children in China have proved effective, according to new research. The study, led by the University of Bristol, reveals regulations recently introduced by the Chinese government to reduce school children's sedentary behavior by restricting online gaming companies catering to this age group, limiting the amount of homework school teachers can assign, and curtailing when private tuition businesses can provide lessons, significantly reduce total sedentary time, as well as how long they spent on different sedentary activities. The measures were associated with a 14% daily sedentary drop overall, equating to more than three-quarters of an hour less time spent in this physically inactive mode. The findings, published in the International Journal of Behavioral Nutrition and Physical Activity, have important implications for future policies and measures aimed at improving children's physical and mental well-being globally. Lead author Dr. Bai Li of the Center for Exercise, Nutrition, and Health Sciences at the University School for Policy Studies said, "The results are exciting as this type of regulatory intervention across multiple settings has never been tried before. Traditionally, children and their parents or caregivers have been guided with education and encouraged to make behavioral changes themselves, which hasn't really worked. With these regulatory measures, the onus has shifted to online gaming companies, schools, and private tutoring companies to comply. This very different approach appears to be more effective, because it is aimed at improving the environment in which children and adolescents live, supporting a healthier lifestyle. Students were also shown to be 20% more likely to meet the screen time recommendations of less than 2 hours daily." Again, just goes to show how important public policy is and the limitations of just trying to use simply education to get people to change their own behavior when the environment's not working to their advantage. Okay, well, next up, I have an interesting public health case study on how we deal with bird flu that would ask us not to repeat one of the similar mistakes that we made with COVID-19. This from Stat News. H5N1, that is the bird flu, doesn't have to be a repeat of COVID-19's public health versus the economy. The Biden administration announced new programs on May 10th to incentivize dairy farmers and workers to collaborate with public health efforts to investigate and mitigate the H5N1 avian influenza outbreak among dairy cattle. Farmers and agriculture officials have called such testing, quote, overreach, telling public health officials to, quote, back off. but the Biden administration's new programs are a first step towards creating trust and collaboration between the public health and industry. Farmers don't want to be identified as H5N1 hotspots for fear that they might end up with milk or beef they can't sell. The industry has already suffered a financial blow, with affected dairies taking as much as a 20% hit to their income, and U.S. cattle prices are dropping as traders fear the outbreak could hurt demand. The USDA already provides financial assistance to livestock, farmed fish, and honeybee farmers who have suffered losses due to disease, animal attacks, and extreme weather. These same funds will be used to compensate dairy farmers whose cows are infected or need to be taken out of milk production. But to qualify for such compensation, dairy farmers will have to agree to participate in enhanced epidemiological surveys and other public health measures. In addition to compensating for lost milk revenue, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will also provide up to $28,000 per farm to support various biosecurity measures, including heat treatment of contaminated milk before disposal, veterinarian costs, shipment of specimens, lab testing, personal protective equipment, and uniform laundering. It's unclear how the USDA will calculate compensation for lost milk revenue. Dairy farms vary tremendously in size, from under 100 cows to more than 15,000. Compensation proportional to the numbers of cows on a farm might be more persuasive. Dairy milk processors and retailers could also be motivated to ensure that the farms from which they source their milk are cooperating with public health officials on surveillance, testing, and mitigation measures. A model for this is the Milk with Dignity program, which focuses on improving working conditions in the dairy industry. Participating dairy farms agree to standards for wages, working hours, housing, and worker health and safety. Independent third parties verify that the dairy farms are complying with these standards. Participating retailers, in turn, commit to sourcing milk from dairy farms that participate in this program. Consumers also have a role to play here by demanding that retailers source their milk from farms that are working with public health authorities. Other forms of industry support may also be needed. If contaminated milking equipment is found to be an important vector of transmission, farmers may need incentives or compensation to purchase more milking equipment and hire more farm workers to maintain the same throughput while allowing for time to sterilize equipment between milking. Currently, only 5 minutes is allocated to milk each cow, and they need to be milked 2 to 3 times per day. It's also unclear why an indemnity program didn't already exist for the dairy industry. Poultry farmers are compensated for poultry they're forced to cull that H5N1 avian flu when H5N1 avian flu is detected on their farms. They're also given incentives to test and detect H5N1 infections quickly to prevent its spread to other farms. They are only compensated for poultry they cull, not those that die from infection. And this program doesn't account for the cost of restocking, downtime, and the delay until the farm becomes profitable again. These programs, however, have been criticized for subsidizing highly profitable big commercial farms without putting pressure on them to do more to change farming practices that may lead to more infectious disease transmission. This is a moment for the USDA and other public health agencies to step back and take stock of whether other risks may exist across the agricultural industry, what incentives may be needed to encourage cooperation with public health officials in the future, and how the farming industry can be encouraged to mitigate risks now. The CDC will compensate dairy farmers $75 for taking part in epidemiologic studies of bird flu, though it's unlikely that will incentivize many workers to participate. It's a notoriously exploitative industry. The working conditions on dairy farms are grueling and dangerous. With few Americans willing to take these jobs, most milkers are foreign-born Hispanic workers, many of whom are undocumented and don't have health insurance. Many speak indigenous languages, not Spanish, much less English, making it more difficult for them to report health and safety violations and access health care and social services. Many can't access health facilities because there isn't good public transportation in rural areas, and they can't get a driver's license in many states. The risks of their work are normalized, and many don't understand that there are ways to reduce and prevent injuries. Despite various chemical and biological risks, including not only bird flu, but also exposure to formaldehyde, chlorine, Q fever, and antibiotic-resistant bacteria, it's uncommon for dairy workers to wear masks or goggles. And even if they understand how to report unsafe working and living conditions, dairy workers are excluded from protections under the Fair Labor Standards Act, Migrant and Seasonal Agriculture Worker Protection Act, and the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Workers who take time off for being sick may be punished with loss of income, housing, and their jobs. And because few have a pathway to legal status in the U.S., the greatest fear for many is being deported. They do not want to come to the attention of any government official. Even the one dairy worker in Texas who was known to have bird flu refused follow-up testing, and his close contacts also refused testing. President Biden has used his executive powers to grant work permits to migrants newly arriving in the country, and many farmers support providing work permits to undocumented farm workers to help address labor shortages. In the absence of legal protections, paid sick leave, and at least temporary legal status in the U.S., it's unlikely that many dairy farm workers will be willing to participate in research to protect America's public health. Many questions remain. The overall risk to farm workers still isn't understood. Based on prior human infections, it's estimated that the mortality rate for bird flu among humans may be above 50%. We don't know what proportion of farm workers and cattle may already have been infected and how well prior infection protects against future infection with bird flu viruses. We don't know how the virus may be mutating with each infection and adapting to human hosts or becoming more transmissible, more virulent, or more resistant to existing antivirals. We don't know if the virus is spreading only through contact with milk or also through the air. We don't know if wearing goggles and masks will reduce the risk of bird flu infection among dairy farm workers, or if other measures like better indoor ventilation and air filtration or disinfection of milk equipment might be more effective. One of the lessons of the COVID-19 pandemic should have been that controlling an infectious disease isn't just a question of having diagnostic tests, treatments, and vaccines. It's also about creating systems that allow people and industry to do the right thing for their own health and for public health without having to take a hit, whether that is losing revenue or wages, jeopardizing a job, or risking deportation. The bird flu outbreak needn't be a rerun of COVID-19's public health versus the economy battle. There's a lot at stake for the U.S. and the rest of the world. No one wants the U.S. dairy industry to become a Wuhan wet market for the next global pandemic. And of course, it's easy to criticize other countries for not having those protections. But in this case, the epicenter is right here. Let's do the right thing. Okay, well, next up, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 30 bonus articles, so let's get rolling. First up, link between e-cigarette use and early age of asthma onset discovered. Not surprisingly, breathing a bunch of chemicals into your lungs can induce the onset of asthma. Bonus article 2, social media use tied to higher odds of smoking and vaping in youth. So this seems to be tied to advertising online and influencers promoting smoking and vaping. Bonus article 3, what do we know about extreme heat's health impacts after the hottest summer on record? This is a good summary of extreme heat's health impacts. Might want to take a look at that. Bonus article 4, how the drug war and energy transition are changing Ecuadorians' fight for the rights of nature. So Ecuador is the country with the most progressive and strong in their national constitution, securing the rights of nature. And it's led to a lot of changes, but they're coming in to a bunch of transitions by having a strong national policy with constitutional rights for nature. A good long read if you want to understand the rights of nature. Bonus article 5. Department of Health and Human Services proposed rule pays lip service to addressing the climate crisis, the greatest threat to human health. So the Biden administration is supposedly trying an all-government effort to deal with climate change, the supposed greatest threat to human health, they say, which I would happen to agree, but what they're doing in the Department of Health and Human Services is basically nothing. They're doing nothing to reduce, for instance, the carbon emissions from the healthcare sector. Bonus article 6, activists meet with Canadian consular to avoid disaster with Line 5 pipeline under Mackinac Strait. So this goes under the, you have been properly warned. I've reported on this before, but this is another request. There's legal battles over this pipeline with 500,000 gallons of oil and liquid natural gas going underneath the Mackinac Straits. And if that were to burst, the Great Lakes would be, it would be disastrous to say the least. Bonus article 7, climate change is likely to aggravate brain conditions. This is just another reminder that our entire body is connected, and climate change with both heat and pollution for instance, as an assault on our body, and as it turns out, the brain is part of our body. So a good overview of how those brain and neurological conditions can be affected by climate change. Bonus Article 8, U.S. shifts to domestic uranium production amid geopolitical tensions. So we used to get most of our uranium from Russia, don't want to do that anymore, so we're shifting back to doing it domestically. Well, we're not importing the dangers of uranium production, now we're going to do it at home. We've already been there and done that. A lot of Native Americans know the pollution on reservations. So hopefully we can avoid some of those same problems. You've been warned. Bonus Article 9, cancer-causing benzene levels were cut in half at U.S. refineries in 2023. So this is a story of transparency. So by requiring these refineries to measure at their fence line different chemicals, in this case benzene, they actually reduce the amounts when you're looking at them. Very good. Bonus Article 10. Only 32% of cancer drugs initially approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration showed an overall survival benefit upon full study. So there's often a push to get drugs approved early, and then they say, well, we'll continue studying it. Well, when they continue studying it, two-thirds of them don't show any overall survival benefit. So there's got to be a balance. Industry, of course, wants to get approved faster on less and less information. Bonus Article 11, prescription drug ads should start looking noticeably different within 6 months. So there's new regs that are going to make the United States is one of only two countries, United States and New Zealand, that allow prescription drug ads on TV directly to consumers, but they're tightening it up and they have 6 months to get their house in order. So we should see some changes. Bonus Article 12. HPV vaccine program tied to big drop in cervical cancers across all socioeconomic strata. So this is an example of when you have a national program for vaccination or other public health programs, they tend to affect the entire population. Some of your programmatic things that only target one population or sometimes the richest and wealthiest, the better off, get a benefit from it, but other socioeconomic strata don't. But in this case, HPV vaccine approves outcomes across all socioeconomic strata. Bonus Article 13. Despite its, quote, nothing burger reputation, COVID-19 remains deadlier than the flu. So as we build up more and more immunity, COVID-19 has gotten less dangerous, although it's still like 35% more dangerous per case of flu hospitalization. COVID hospitalization versus a flu hospitalization. But the thing you remember is when you say deadlier, it's not just per case. It's the fact that COVID-19 is many, many, many times more infectious than the flu. So you get many, many, many times more cases. So the overall impact is much larger than just the 35% greater of a hospitalization case of COVID-19 versus the flu. Bonus Article 14, U.S. drowning deaths rising again after years of decline, remaining the leading cause of death for toddlers ages 1 to 4. Yep, those little kids, you got to watch out. You need to have some safety training. Be careful, because that's a leading cause of death for kids 1 to 4. Drowning. Bonus Article 15, miscare, fewer patients. Rural families and clinics feel Medicaid disenrollments. So we're starting to see the results of people who were on Medicaid that actually increased during the pandemic when people weren't allowed to be kicked off. Now they did a huge, unwinding, and they've actually kind of overshot it. So that's having its impacts. A related story, Bonus Article 16, Medicaid unwinding decried as bias against disabled people. There's often different requirements for disabled people versus the general population. And sometimes that's not paid closely attention to, and they get bumped off without even any notice. And disabled people are particularly dependent upon their health coverage, Medicaid in this case. Bonus Article 17, Medicaid unwinding deals blow to tenuous system of care for Native Americans, who are about twice as likely to be on Medicaid, and the Native American health care system is more tenuous, so they're getting hitting harder as well. Bonus Article 18, social determinants of health explain most of the disparity in treatment-resistant hypertension among white and black U.S. adults. So I've included this article because historically there's been a lot of racist beliefs that somehow blacks are much, are more likely to get hypertension and suffer consequences from it, when in fact the overwhelming majority of that is simply determined by social determinants, factors in the community outside of the individuals. It's not a race issue, it's a racialization of a population and systematic discrimination over generations. In a related article, bonus article 19, how power and status shapes behavior, evidence of bias from physicians. This was a really interesting military study where they looked at how physicians treated people based on their rank and their race, and sure enough, lots of bias to go around. Bonus article 20, removing race adjustment from lung tests would mean higher disability payments for many black vets, adding over $1 billion per year in benefits. So this is something I've reported on before. This has been debunked about having a differential measure for based on race, and it's obviously it's harming black vets versus others. Bonus article 21, the lure of specialty medicine pulls nurse practitioners from primary care. So the very same milieu that of for-profit medicine and higher pay, for instance, is pulling nurse practitioners just as is other healthcare providers. Bonus article 22, the only tribal medical school in the U.S. graduates its first Native American doctors. So some years back, the Cherokee tribe started their own medical school. Good for them. It's starting to pay off. Bonus article 23, why one New York health system stopped suing its patients. Well, this might most aptly be put as they got tired of trying to get blood out of a turnip. It's not good business sense at any level to try to get blood out of a turnip. Bonus article 24, study highlights inappropriate antibiotic prescribing in U.S. emergency departments. So this is about antimicrobial resistance that's developed by using antibiotics inappropriately when they don't need to be used, overusing them. So that's happening a lot in ERs around the country. Bonus article 25, treating chronic pain requires much more than medications. Yes, so we have a tendency to just, you know, is there a pill for that? When in fact, having comprehensive interdisciplinary teams works a lot better. Bonus article 26, patients fare better when they get palliative care sooner, not later. Now, palliative care is often assumed to be end-of-life care, but actually palliative care is just any care that's not directed specifically at a healthcare outcome or condition. It's actually treating the person rather than the condition. And not surprisingly, when you treat patients as in whole people, not just as conditions, they actually do better. Maybe we should start that from birth rather than when people get old and very, very sick.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Bonus article 27. There's bird flu in the U.S. dairy cows. Raw milk drinkers increase despite risk. So this is kind of the crazy thing. They're actually selling more raw milk because, you know, kind of that conspiracy theory world I don't know, that raw milk is dangerous. You should avoid it, but particularly with bird flu, only makes it more dangerous. Bonus article 28, North Carolina bill to curb mask wearing in protests could make it illegal for medical reasons too. Unfortunately, there are a lot of good reasons and for vulnerable people to wear masks for medical reasons. Hate to be arrested for wearing a mask, yikes. Bonus article 29, attack jets' noise pollution may be harming 74,000 people's health in Washington. So this is a specific example of noise pollution, and just reminding us that noise pollution is a public health problem, and jets rumbling by your house can be a particular problem. Bonus article 30, last but not least, U.S. doctors trapped in Gaza hospital by Israeli assault. 35 doctors wait for escape and for replacements. So the Gaza hospital system has been pretty much wiped out, but they have relied on additional doctors coming in to provide services and bring in supplies. But the Israelis have cut that off, and there's doctors that are stuck there and can't get out, and they can't get replacements or, perhaps even more importantly, medical supplies in. So this is another example of the ongoing and escalating genocide in Gaza. Genocide is a public health crisis. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on, including previous episodes, by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.